Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and it's Friday, which means it's time for our First Coast Week in Review. Among our topics, Five Points could be losing its historic centerpiece, another DA teacher is removed from class over allegations of sexual misconduct, and the Duval School District restarts its superintendent search. Later on, we'll be joined by Mixmaster David Luckin for his this week's Jacksonville Music Experience DJ session. But first, I'm joined by reporter and First Coast News anchor Rich Donnelly. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Ann Maxwell, investigative reporter at News for Jax. Good morning.
Good morning.
Jacksonville Business Journal editor Tim Gibbons. Hi, Tim.
Good to be here.
And Florida Times Union watchdog reporter Hannah Holthaus. Hey, Hannah.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, Hannah, let's start with a story that blew up earlier this week, first on social and then kind of on every news outlet in Jacksonville. What's happening in Five Points?
So on Tuesday, a petition started going wild on social media saying that the building that houses Sunray Cinema, Brew Five Points, and various office buildings was going to be going up for sale. In the petition, it said that it was going up for sale and the potential new owners were considering putting in a parking garage where that building is. And so as you can imagine, people started freaking out. There were thousands of signatures on the petition already. The petition went straight to the inbox of the current owner. People were panicking, which makes sense because people really love that building and it has a huge impact in Five Points. Now, that being said, it can't necessarily be turned into a parking garage the way that that was originally anticipated. We did some reporting to say, you know, it is a historic landmark. Turning into anything else or demolishing it in general would take so many hoops to jump through. And then the petition kind of changed to say, well, they're thinking about putting in a virtual golf course or something other than Sunray Cinema. And so that is still getting a lot of attention.
And so this was a case where the social media narrative got a little bit out, you know, over its skis, and your reporting, and I think all of the reporting that subsequent to that, you know, kind of clarified that. But it is a circumstance in which you wonder if it shadows the debate to the point that it kind of, Rich, makes it harder to for people to focus on the fact that the cinema itself may be threatened.
So oh, absolutely. You know, a lot of people really love that part of town and love the kitschiness, if you will, of the independent theater. We saw the San Marco Theater shut its doors, I believe, 1 year ago, almost to the, was it 2 years ago at this point? But still shut its doors, an independent film. And Jacksonville used to be such a hub of movies. And at the time that that building came to fruition was when a lot of movies were made in Jacksonville, well before Hollywood really took form. During the previous, not this past Oscar season, but the one before, I did a story with a independent filmmaker who, the film's called The Artifice Girl. I highly recommend it, actually. But he made his film exclusively with Jacksonville actors, producers, directors, tech people, and his film was shown in Sunray. And he said it's a beacon of hope for people like him who want to one day become, you know, maybe the next Quentin Tarantino or big time Hollywood filmmaker. He has his roots in Jacksonville, and he and many other artists identify with the idea that is Sunray Cinema and independent films and a place for their films to be shown. And they do show other movies as well. But, you know, Cinemark doesn't show The Artifice Girl. Doors closing like that, to me, almost signify doors closing on opportunities for some of our neighbors who are looking to make it big and have an avenue for that.
So, Tim, this is now, after he said, you know, the closing of Theater Jacksonville, it's now the only single screen theater in the city that remains. And it is more than that, though. It really is kind of the heart and soul, in a lot of ways, of Five Points.
It is. And I think the entire change there, you know, it's not going to become almost certainly will not become a parking garage. But the theater going away hits people in a very real way. But it's a sign of changing Jacksonville. I mean, you know, if you go back to Five Points 20 years ago, it was much grungier. Yes. Had a totally different feel. Wall Street, one of the oldest bars in the county, is under new ownership. They're changing what they're doing there. The entire strip of Five Points has changed massively in the past couple years. You can call it gentrification. You can just call it changing. But when we talk about Jacksonville growing, that is part of what happens. These little local places can get squeezed out. They don't have to get squeezed out, but it is a side effect oftentimes of rents going up and new building owners coming in.
And when this took life on social media. There was a lot of anger being vented at the ownership. And, you know, the owner, Jack Shad, has since come out to say, you know, he's been really the champion of that building and he mm-hmm. supported its designation. It was under his ownership that it got the historic designation that will, as Hannah said, protect it from being demolished. But it appears that a different use is, you know, coming. And this the theater owner or the theater managers say that they've not been offered an opportunity to extend their lease. So that does suggest that it will be something other than the Sunray going forward.
Yeah, I'm not sure what exactly the historic designation means for the interior of the building and you know, what could be done with that. But certainly people have a lot of interest in what goes in that spot. I mean, there's a limited number of storefronts in Five Points, and there's been a lot of turnover there. And so I think, especially such a big, iconic space like that, people are really interested in what's going there. And I think that the, you know, rumor going around about the parking garage is really what set that aflame. And now that eyes are on it, people are really going to be curious and invested in what is going to go there, which sounds like it could be a positive thing going forward.
Hannah, the people who started that petition, as you said, sort of changed the language. And I think they've gone back since and sort of taken out even the virtual golf mention. Their concern is that while this, you know, petition caught fire, obviously got a lot of people's attention, that, you know, they're concerned that people involved could make, you know, solutions that maybe aren't what they're most concerned about, you know, that they'll say, well, we're going to protect it. It's not going to be a parking garage or it's not going to be virtual golf. But the people who are behind the petition really want it to remain Sunray.
They do. And I think that that's what we're seeing on social media is this fervor to protect Sunray. And so Sunray is something that I don't think is widely talked about is Sunray is a tenant of this building, right? So the people who own Sunray Cinema are trying to operate a new theater in Daytona as well. They've made bids to purchase other or to rent out other spaces around. And so if the new building owner were to decide not to extend Sunray Cinema's lease, right, they still could hypothetically bring in a new tenant to still operate Five Points Theater as a building, as a theater. Might not be a movie theater, might be, you know, like a Florida theater situation, but they could bring another tenant to do that. And that's something that isn't necessarily being talked about. And I think it's because people really love what the owners of Sunray have done for that community, but they've only been operating since 2011. So I think that is an important distinction to make here.
Yeah. I mean, when I first moved here, Tim, it was a nightclub. It was Club Five and there was, you know, big bands there all the time. Then it was kind of a dance bar. So it's had a few different iterations, obviously. But the programming, as Hannah says, is one of the unique things about that place is that there is this local investment. You know, the Tim Bassett recently showed, he and his wife, Shanna, who own it, they were showing like a 1960s, you know, film about consolidation, you know, that was made when the city was consolidating, it kind of trying to sell the community on this idea. So it's kind of funny and not something you would see.
I went to a Bollywood film festival there. That's not the type of thing that you get in, you know, typical movie theaters. And I think that is one of the things that advocates for the theater don't want to lose. In some ways, I think this is almost a citywide conversation we have to have of how do we keep Jacksonville as Jacksonville? It's the thing that motivates the conversations about the Trio, for example, the Laura Street Trio. Jacksonville has this history of knocking down the things that make Jacksonville, Jacksonville. And in some ways, it's a good thing from a development standpoint for rents to go up. It's a good thing for buyers from out of the market to come in. Those are all good things for the local real estate economy. But we have to have a conversation of how do we keep Jacksonville special and not have it just become Tampa or Savannah or Orlando or some other city where everything's kind of generic.
Does the city have any interest, Tim, in getting involved in something like this, trying to use its, you know, a bully pulpit to protect
I would think they probably have bigger things on their plate. Yeah, I mentioned the Trio. Yeah, talk about the stadium. They got, you know, plenty of other irons in the fire.
Yeah, Hannah.
So actually, in a story that published yesterday on Jacksonville.com, I did talk to Councilmember Jimmy Peluso, who's the council member for this district. And what he's thinking about doing is introducing some type of legislation in the future that, to Ann's point of not knowing how the landmark designation could protect the inside, it would extend landmark designation to the interior And so that's not necessarily for just this building. That could be for other landmark applications in the future, and that would have to be approved. And again, that wouldn't, in the case of, you know, Five Points Theater, Sunray Cinema, that wouldn't necessarily mean that the business owner had to retain Sunray as its tenant, but it could protect the building's use as some sort of theater, which would protect it from, oh, a virtual golf course or, you know, what have you.
There is some fear, though, that if you do that with the interior, that it locks the building in place too much, that you couldn't make it, you know, a nightclub then. You couldn't, as the building owner, do what you wanted with it, which could make a building owner less likely to support, you know, historic designation status.
I mean, I can see people really being resistant to that, Rich, just because it already takes a lot when you're restoring a historic building to get that done. The costs are enormous. But in fact, if this, you know, had been in place, it would not have been able to be sustainable during the years it was a nightclub if you couldn't, you know, kind of modify its uses somewhat.
Oh, absolutely. And then you talk about just renovations and upkeep. Like, you know, depending on what the interior of the historic designation would be, if there's water damage, do you then have to repair it in the manner in which it originally was? I think that opens a Pandora's box of a nightmare scenario for, you know, a business owner who at the end of the day is trying to turn a profit for whatever their business may be. And then you have the owner of the building beyond just the business owners who are renting from them, collecting rent and ownership there. And this is not a popular opinion, but that area could actually use more parking. Like, I'm not saying that, you know, that should turn into
a parking you're advocating
garage.
For a parking garage? Is that what you're doing?
You are going to get lit up
on the radio?
Media.
Okay, cool.
It's one of those things that as it comes out of my mouth, I was like, oh, this is going the wrong direction. But, and again, it, you know, personal opinions aside of, you know, what the theater should become, it is a pain in the neck to find parking in that area. Again, I'm not saying that the theater should be, but I wonder when it comes to older parts of town that were developed really before the explosion of population and the way that people live their lives these days. So many people stream movies. So going to a Sunray Cinema is the event of let's go get a bowl of popcorn. Let's go somewhere where there's a ticket that's torn and we go find our seat. And the idea of the big screen as opposed to the oversized plasma screen that you have in your own living room, it's an activity, but it's also an activity that is slightly antiquated in today's day and age because they show their movie at this time and you can't pause it when you want to go to your fridge. Like it's a different idea. So I'm curious to see how an independent theater that's not available to all the different show times and, you know, 18 cinema, you know, rooms, if you will, how they are going to just adapt with Americans' current lifestyle.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough time for movie theaters, even multiplexes right now. And it's not, you know, a lot has changed about the movie industry.
Yeah, and I think people are just really busy. I mean, as you got to get in your car and sit in traffic and find a parking spot. And people just have a lot going on. And it's just so easy to just flop on the couch and zone out and binge a TV show. I mean, because there's so many options out there. You know, you don't have to go to the theater to see the big new movie. I mean, you've got a whole library on your TV at home. So, I mean, I think that's a big challenge for that industry.
Hannah, I know you'll be continuing to follow this story. Do we know what next steps might be?
I mean, not really. I know that there's going to be a demonstration at City Hall of residents who are looking to support Sunray Cinema. And so that's on Tuesday at 4 p.m. But otherwise, I mean, the city can advocate for Sunray. They can advocate for certain things. But at the end of the day, if the current owner chooses to sell to this new potential buyer, the city can't really do anything about that. And so it'll be a matter of what is the building currently zoned for that will, you know, potentially change the inside of the use. Do we look at making interior landmark status? Is that something they're able to do? And so it's kind of a question mark going forward.
All right. Well, let's move on now to a headline that unfortunately evokes a feeling of deja vu. A teacher removed from the classroom at Douglas Anderson School for the Arts over allegations of sexual misconduct. And you've reported on this topic extensively. And unfortunately, it seems like it keeps happening. What's going on?
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. So there was an algebra teacher, Christopher Allen Black, who was at a Disney hotel resort in February, and several people reported seeing him fondling himself in the window facing the pool of a second story hotel room, and, you know, called law enforcement, and they arrested him, charged him with a misdemeanor for exposure. And so what I've been hearing from sources is, you know, we've had 4 other teachers removed from the classroom in the past year or so.
This is the fifth.
So, you know, there's started with Jeffrey Clayton, longtime music teacher who was arrested, accused of inappropriately texting and touching a student. Several other teachers removed from the classroom following that amid investigations. And so this, what I'm hearing, just really feels like a gut punch to people who were hoping, you know, things might be different going forward, who have been traumatized, you know, with their experiences at DA in the past, and where the story gets, you know, even more disturbing is that we learned last night from the district that they knew about his arrest within 3 days back in February. He was allowed to stay in the classroom until April 11th, and then families were notified about this on Wednesday, that he was going to be removed pending an internal investigation. And the reason the district said he was not, you know, he was allowed to stay in the classroom for so long is because they learned about the arrest through like a background screening process they have that they have to have per state law and policy. And they said initially the district followed protocol regarding a misdemeanor arrest and failure to report it to the district while we sought guidance from the Office of General Counsel. So, I mean, I think that just kind of plays into the mistrust people have had with the school district and Douglas Anderson in particular when it comes to handling these kinds of issues.
And so that statement that you're reading mentions failure to report. Is it our understanding that the teacher was arrested and didn't tell the district as required?
That is my understanding.
And so they're saying they would have been pausing any action while they're asking their attorney what to do in a case where someone doesn't report properly. And as they're waiting for that opinion, he's continuing to teach.
Right. You know, as an employee, you have certain rights. I know they have a union to deal with. So that's what they're saying the policy is a misdemeanor. You know, so you kind of understand why that's the policy. But when you put it into the context of what's happened at Douglas Anderson over the past year or so, I think that's what makes it disturbing to people.
Yeah, it really does seem to be just, as I said, a feeling of deja vu to him. And obviously, teachers do have protections. But there are, I think, expectations from parents that at the very least, a teacher would be reassigned to a no contact position, even pending an investigation or any kind of, you know, criminal outcome.
Right. There's many, many things that the school district could do that are not terminate the teacher, which is, I'm not going to weigh in on what should be done in the situation. But the idea that there are options, and if they're doing an investigation, they're looking at it, the idea of simply removing him from students while they figure out what they're supposed to do would seem to be a more logical course of action.
And to be clear, he has been removed from the classroom pending an internal investigation, but that didn't happen for weeks after the arrest.
We've got a call. Charles on the West Side. Good morning, Charles. Welcome to First Coast Connect. Charles, you there? I may have lost you, Charles. We have a message from Deb on Facebook. Just want to throw in. It says, good point about losing our history, Tim Gibbons. We lost our beautiful San Marco Theater. My grandma took me, and they used to show many foreign language films. So, I mean, definitely a lot of fond memories of that. Rich, returning to the subject of Douglas Anderson, the situation with Jeffrey Clayton, which kind of initiated this whole process, that also was investigated by the same office that is now looking into this case and into, you know, what happened. Is there a sense in the community that there should be perhaps another set of eyes on some of these complaints rather than internally having these reviews done? It's the Office of Professional Standards that investigates these claims. But as we've heard from past students, you know, they've made complaints, particularly about Jeffrey Clayton, many years prior to, and nothing happened.
I do get the sense that there's a large sense of distrust between students, alumni of specifically this school and the administration. And to be fair, the principal has changed hands. So, you know, a new principal, maybe give them the benefit of the doubt to try and initiate their own policies and stance and procedures, but right away it seems that the ball has been dropped. Now, Jeffrey Clayton, to go back to the initial, you know, the teacher arrest that started an avalanche of reports, when I was outside of the campus of Douglas Anderson right after that arrest, one student said that he specifically, that student, had been making reports to the school and it falling on deaf ears. And then through many reporters at our station who have followed that story, multiple former teachers and alumni of that school have said for years they were reporting on Jeffrey Clayton in particular, and nothing was done. Not so much as just an investigation. So to see this happen now again, and I spoke with a parent of a student at Douglas Anderson yesterday, and that parent said her child had him as a math teacher last year. However, the email that went out to parents last week, I believe, only went to the parents of students who have him this year as an algebra teacher. So the question that this parent raised was, well, hold on, his interactions with students aren't explicitly only in his classroom during class time. He could be walking down the hall, see a student that he had the year before. And that parent was highly questioning the school and the district of what is going on. Like, all parents should be, this parent's belief, all parents should be told what is happening in their child's school, regardless of who the teacher has in terms of students. And then that email also went to, you know, reassure the parents that their child's math would not suffer. But then this parent brought up the point, well, will my child's current math teacher be reassigned? Will there be sort of a domino effect? And granted, that is a secondary issue to, you know, lewd and lascivious acts and the arrest. But there seems to be a sense that I get from parents and students that this is not a well thought out punishment and course going forward by the school and by extension then the district.
We've got a call. Shyla, former DA student. Good morning, Shyla. Go ahead.
Morning, Ann. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I would agree with everything you guys have said so far. And definitely, I would say this falls squarely on the district. Specifically, you know, what happened here, and I think it's easy for parents and your listeners to kind of put it all on the principal, because that's what we see. And I want to kind of frame it in a different kind of context. When the district finds out, whether the principal reports it or not, and this is kind of what we've been talking about, that clear line of communication, the principal can't remove him. The district has to. So that's Vicki Schultz, Scott Schneider. That's that level of, you know, kind of coming in, taking action. So even if the principal came in and understood and all of that, you know, got reported to her, basically she's got to wait for them to make that call. So they really, again, had to come in and make this decision. So I really, this falls squarely in their court, and their inaction, again, is just something that we've seen over and over and over again. So I want this to come to light because this same thing happened back in Inglewood in September. Now, in that case, they did pull that assistant coach out very quickly, but the parents weren't notified until November when the news got a hold of it. It's that reactionary, you know, kind of understanding of, oh no, we've been caught. The news is going to, you know, out us. Now we're going to tell the parents. And I stood in front of the board and said, your policy is not helping. It's not building trust with the parents. It's not building the relationship you want. And here we are yet again, a fifth teacher at Douglas Anderson, the school that has, you know, been hit over and over by this type of, you know, involvement. And it really, it's not a good look for us. And it just really hurts my heart that these kids who've been through so much in less than a year have to deal with this again.
Thanks, Shyla. I mean, Hannah, this is obviously an issue that, you know, it's not confined to Douglas Anderson. Schools have this problem. Every business has this problem, unfortunately. But there does seem to be, at this point, a level of higher expectation that the district perhaps be moving more aggressively when it comes to the school particularly?
I would assume so, yes, just because there have been, you know, more teachers than we would have expected in a pretty short amount of time that, you know, have been removed from the classroom or what have you. And so I think that for parents, that kind of brings up what the caller is saying. You know, do we have to wait for this to get to the news, to journalists, in order to know about it? And so I think that that's going to put a real magnifying glass on what's happening at Douglas Anderson. So that way parents can be aware of whenever a teacher is removed for whatever reason.
And do you get a sense that is there something different about Douglas Anderson? I mean, it's a magnet art school. Does that play any role in these issues, or what is unique, if anything?
I'm glad you asked that. So what I hear from sources is that, you know, it has this reputation as this great art school with these wonderful outside resources. There's lots of money raised through the foundation, you know, to go on trips, and I'm visiting artists. And some of these kids come from, you know, vulnerable socioeconomic backgrounds, and they're told, you know, you can make it in the arts and make it big. But we can't let on that anything is ever wrong here, because then the money stops flowing in and kids don't have these great opportunities. And so there's a sense from former students that, you know, when there is inappropriate behavior, administrators look the other way, which former principal Jackie Cornelius has denied. But many people have said, you know, to Rich's point, I complained about Jeffrey Clayton for years and nothing happened. And his personnel file backs that up. And there's other complaints as well. And there's a sense that the culture allowed, you know, misconduct to continue unchecked.
We have a call from Regina in Mandarin. Good morning, Regina. Go ahead.
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call. We keep going around and round and round, and this we're sort of scratching the surface. You have to define the problem before you find a solution. So why does this keep happening over and over again? Is it the superintendent's responsibility? Should there be a task force for this? Should there, you know, and is our girls not taken seriously? You know, again, it doesn't seem logical to keep happening over and over again. And I'll take your comments off the air. Thanks for taking my call. Have a good day.
Sure. Thank you, Gina. I mean, Tim, in fact, Diana Green, the former superintendent, Dr. Green, did kind of lose her job. I mean, she says it was, you know, her decision, but she was under a lot of pressure at the time. And much of that was because of what was happening at Douglas Anderson.
Right. Yeah. So we don't directly cover education, but obviously there is a general sense that the top person in the district does bear some responsibility, that if there is a pervasive problem, that's why you have a superintendent to deal with, you know, a situation that needs to be dealt with.
Yeah. We have a call, Charles on the West Side. Good morning, Charles. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. I'm wondering now with the school chaplains in place, will they have a duty to report, much like, you know, doctors and caregivers and stuff, you know, if they see signs of abuse or have a problem reported to them? So, you know, so these new chaplains, if the student says, hey, you know, this teacher has been putting their hands on me, do they have a duty then to report that? And then will there be a mechanism in place to process that report?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that there's a lot of things we don't know about this new school chaplain program that the governor just signed into law. So some of those things may be yet to be determined. But typically, Anne, anybody that's in a position, you know, as an employee of the school, would have that duty to report. And I think that that's been one of the concerns about this, is that there are other adults that were aware of complaints about some of these teachers. And did they report to DCF, which would be the agency that investigates that kind of thing? Or were they just, you know, passing them along to a superior or perhaps nobody?
Yeah. To start with the issue of the chaplains, I would think that they would be mandatory reporters. And then, you know, one really interesting case that I feel like hasn't gotten enough attention regarding, you know, adjacent to Douglas Anderson, is the story of Dwayne Sykes, who was this former Vistar employee who was convicted for embezzling millions and millions of dollars from them. And now he's been charged, accused of using that money to pay boys for sex, for nude photos. It's basically like a huge child sex trafficking ring the federal government has said has been going, you know, went on for a decade or so. And some of those victims were from Douglas Anderson, apparently, according to the federal court filings. And so there's one instance one of the prosecutors lays out in that case where there was a teacher at DA who casually mentioned it to an officer that everybody knows all these kids are going to this guy's house to party and have sex. and everybody knows about it. And so the officers came in and did an investigation, and several teachers and even the principal, you know, said that they had heard about it. And, you know, I think it kind of goes back to that culture of, you know, what can I, of not really taking action. And so that to me was just like a really disturbing example of that.
I mean, that's really shocking. And so is there any next steps for those teachers? At the very least, some additional training, education about what it means to be a mandatory reporter?
Yeah, that's a good question. And at a school board meeting earlier this month, you know, the district did, in the wake of Jeffrey Clayton's arrest, hire an outside law firm to do an investigation into how these complaints about misconduct are handled at DA and I believe throughout the district. And he said that, you know, they had identified some changes they can make, some improvements they're working to implement. But, you know, I mean, it's been more than a year since Jeffrey Clayton was arrested, and I think people are eager to, you know, maybe see more training, more change, more proactivity.
More something. I mean, there is this investigation that's been underway. It does seem surprising that it's still not concluded.
Yep. And there's apparently like more than 100 interviews they're conducting, thousands of pages of documents. I mean, it kind of raises your eyebrows, like, you know, maybe it's worse than they expected. I don't know. They've had a lot to go through.
Well, if you're just joining us, we're talking about the top stories of the week with our panel of journalists. You can join our conversation at 904-549-2937. You can email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. You can message us on the First Coast Connect Facebook or Instagram pages, or you can turn on the live stream on Facebook or YouTube and watch us do our thing here. I want to move on now. Rich, the governor has been in town a lot, signing a lot of education-related bills. We just mentioned one with the school chaplains. But one in particular aims to clarify an earlier law that allowed parents to challenge books in school libraries. In fact, allowed people who weren't parents of kids in school to challenge books in school libraries. And remind us how we got here.
So I was actually at the governor's reelection party in Tampa on election night. And he got up on the pulpit and he very proudly proclaimed that Florida is where woke goes to die. And that was at the height of the Don't Say Gay law and his lawsuits against Disney, and books were being banned, although his office was very quick to say that they were not banned. They were being taken off the shelves and reviewed. Well, a gentleman in Clay County has asked for more books to be banned or reviewed than practically the entire state of Missouri. The state of Missouri has a significantly larger population than that of Clay County, and certainly that gentleman's own home. So it's gotten out of control, and we've reported pictures of empty shelves in some, you know, school, you know, libraries and things like that. And I don't think that Governor DeSantis will ever walk back his comment about Florida's where woke goes to die, but he's certainly fine-tuned exactly what he's looking for. And now there's the new legislation that if you do not have a child in that school, you can only request like one book to be reviewed at a time. And I do believe it still, if I remember the legislation correctly, gives parents of students still the latitude they want in order to challenge the books in their own children's classrooms. But things have gotten out of control, especially in Clay County, where Clay County leads the state and the state leads the nation, far, far reaching. I think Florida accounts for nearly three quarters of all banned or mandatory reviewed books in the country. And at a certain point, kids have to read some books.
Yeah, well, if Florida leads the nation in the number of banned books and Clay County leads the state, clearly we're number one. But this one gentleman, Bruce Friedman, he represents a group called No Left Turn in Education, and he requested about 94% of these books. He doesn't have a student in the school there. But it's interesting, Tim, because this obviously was a signature issue for a while for the governor. But now he is trying to untangle it. He said that, you know, some people made a mockery of the process.
There's, I don't know, sometimes it's interesting seeing things like this play out where it's hard to say this was an unintended consequence. It's hard to say that this was unforeseen. Clearly, the way the law was laid out, it was set up for somebody who, you know, wants to see reading go to die, that they can, anybody can go and challenge anything. This is what you're going to get. And maybe this is my own slight touch of cynicism, but when you see somebody go like, oh, they're misusing the system, when that's how the system was set up, it seems disingenuous.
You mean that the bill was designed to disrupt the...
Exactly.
Yeah, well, it certainly has given a lot of school librarians a headache, and it's... but, there's... The political fortunes of some conservatives have really been bolstered by efforts like this. It certainly has kind of appealed to the base. But you think, too, about, the whole Moms for Liberty movement. Sometimes they can become an embarrassment as opposed to an asset. And, I guess that's a little bit of what's happening in this case, trying to undo what was done.
Yeah, I think that this move shows that those kinds of headlines are something the state administration doesn't want. These headlines about people without a child in the district, asking for all these books to be removed and whatnot. I think that shows that those kinds of headlines aren't something they see as positive.
Another law that the governor signed in this week, Hannah, was mandating anti-communism teaching. It's now students will have to learn about the dangers and evils of communism very explicitly. And there's kind of some curriculum that attends to that. But that, too, it's interesting. I mean, it seems sort of countering to some messaging that Republicans have out there, which, seemed sympathetic to Vladimir Putin, has seen, sympathetic to not funding Ukraine defenses. And so it seems like a little bit of a muddied message there. I mean, if we're anti-communist, we're going to be teaching, our students that communism is evil. How does that square politically with the larger kind of Republican frame?
I mean, I think that's the big question, right? Because people want to campaign on certain things. They want to act in certain ways, whether it's not giving money and aid to Ukraine, whether it's, headlines about what we're teaching in schools. But if we break it all down, the real challenge is going to be for the teachers. How are the teachers going to navigate that? And I think that that's what's going to be really interesting whenever some of these laws come into play. If I'm a teacher in the Duval County District, and this is the message that I'm getting, how am I going to square that with student questions that are inevitably going to pop up about what's currently happening in the world?
It is a complicated world, Rich, for teachers, no doubt. But this is also an issue of, recruiting our new superintendent, and that search has gotten underway yet again. They had to kind of abort their search in October because they didn't get enough applicants, enough qualified applicants. They got, I think, 11. Ish. This time they have more, but how is that? How do we think the community is looking at this new superintendent search in terms of, finding the right person at a difficult time for schools and a difficult time for Florida in education?
Well, it's certainly a very difficult time, and I feel that this district, Duval County Public Schools, is really at a crossroads right now on where they want to go. There's the possibility that a number of schools might have to close or be consolidated due to budget cuts. And a lot of those budget cuts are coming because so many charter schools have popped up and the actual population of students in DCPS has dropped dramatically, so much so that many neighborhood elementary schools are on this list of potential closings. Atlantic Beach Elementary, many neighbors in that area are putting up yard signs of Save Our School, and they attended a workshop at district headquarters and a school board meeting recently to voice their disgust that their school is performing well, but just due to outside influences well beyond the walls of their own neighborhood school, their school is on the list of something that may need to be consolidated. So a lot of neighbors don't feel that it's fair. One school board member that I spoke to a couple weeks ago before news broke about everything that might be closed, he said that he was not at a board meeting workshop because he was actually touring some of the schools that might be closed. And he said at that time that Westside High was on the list. And he thought it impossible that that would have to come to fruition. But he said that's sort of the narrative we're in. So I can understand why there might not be a wealth of applicants applying for a job when they notice that the district that they'd be then in charge of is not necessarily trending in a upward direction that would be a cushy landing spot, if you will.
We have a comment from Stanley on Facebook. He says, why are so many civic and social pathologies in Jacksonville? That's an interesting question, Tim. I'm going to ask you if you have an interesting answer.
I do not.
Okay.
But I do think the idea of finding a new superintendent, I mean, somebody who covers business, the idea of hiring into an organization that clearly is struggling. You look at how the last couple superintendents have left. It's easy to see why the job would not be appealing.
One call from Linda, and I think we're going to have to wrap it. Linda, go ahead.
Yeah, just quickly. I was calling to ask, I know that during all of this, Governor DeSantis comes to Jacksonville a lot to sign legislation. And I'm just trying to wonder, when he's signing legislation about schools, he has kids. I don't know if they're school age in Tallahassee. Does he have a house here? Or I'm just trying to figure out, because it seems like we're constantly being in the frame of what's going on. Book bans, they were showing books of our schools bare. And then he was, denigrating our, our representative, saying the way they were trying to make him look bad. So why is he always coming to Jacksonville? He's got a whole state.
Yeah, that's a good question, Linda. Obviously, a lot of supporters here, and he does kind of favor a certain charter school. He kind of makes frequent appearances at. We're going to have to leave
fair,
it there.
We are also very close to Tallahassee compared to Miami.
Right.
So it's drivable for him.
We're going to have to leave it there. It's time for our lightning round. Tim Gibbons, what's on your plate?
Working on an interesting story about the Springfield neighborhood and its efforts to capitalize on art as an economic development tool.
Excellent. Rich, yeah. What's on yours?
I'll be in the courtroom, the Jared Bridegan murder trial. And Jared Bridegan was murdered. The people who are accused of murdering him and the defense teams that are hoping to throw the state attorney's office off the case.
Ann Maxwell.
I'm going to go in a different direction. Taylor Swift's new album just came out at midnight. For those of you living under a rock, I am still listening to it. It's very sad, but I'm going to be listening to that this weekend.
Oh, excellent.
Being emo, maybe.
How about you, Hannah?
I'm in the same boat as Anne. But next Tuesday, City Council will be voting on the zoning for the controversial storage unit on the South Bank.
Oh, that's a big issue. Well, we had Jacksonville actor Jason Woods on the program earlier this week, and he'd actually written a poem for us. So we asked him to record it, and I want to play it for you. But first, Rich Donnelly, Anne Maxwell, Hannah Holthouse, Tim Gibbons, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Anne.
And we'll be back in just a minute.
WJCT's my favorite station. My place for music, art, and contemplation. It's the home of shows that demand your respect. All things considered and First Coast Connect. Get the app. It's better than Tinder. It's where I met Stacy and the host and Schindler. I learn about things like Mozart and Palladio. 89.9, the best in local radio.
At Vistar Credit Union, we believe in helping members reach their financial goals and building stronger communities. It's why we offer our members better rates and give back to the places we call home. Vistar Credit Union. Visit vistarcu.org/join.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. Serious injury cases are complex, and civil trial attorneys present the evidence juries need to see and hear. More at waynehogan.law.
North Florida TPO, proud sponsor of WJCT's First Coast Connect, bringing to the community innovation in transportation planning, commuter services, clean fuels, and intelligent transportation systems. More at northfloridatpo.com.
Join WJCT for Be My Neighbor Day, a free family festival on May 11th at WJCT Studios. Meet Daniel Tiger and friends, visit community helpers, and much more. Reserve your spot today at wjct.org/events.
Kidney transplants and unlearning silence in healthcare. I'm Dr. Joe Servin. Join me tomorrow at 4 for What's Health Got to Do with It, only on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville.
Welcome back. Well, by the end of the week, you've probably had your fill of news, and fortunately, 89.9 turns its airwaves over to the Jacksonville Music Experience on Saturday and Sunday nights. And one of those programs is Electro Lounge, which airs at 10 o'clock Saturday nights, and I am joined now by its host, David Luckin, for a preview. Hey, David.
It is so nice to be here, and if you've been a fan of Electro Lounge for the last 20 years and you know Thievery Corporation, we're going to play some music from Eric Hilton's new release. But up first, Cherry Golden Waters from DeFazz's brand new album. I'm going to give it to Ann now. It's a play on the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds. It's called DeFazz Presents Pit Sounds. And it's a really good album. I had to wait to have it shipped all the way from Germany. It was well worth the wait. We'll be playing it from vinyl on Saturday night, too. Here's a little bit of DeFazz from their latest release.
So that's a featured artist, Electro Lounge. That just like reeks of Electro Lounge when I hear it. It's just so, so they're German?
They're German from Heidelberg, and they are probably, they tour all the time. They're big in Europe. I wish they'd come to America. I would pay lots to see them in person. And they started with God's Dog in 1998, and they've just been so good forever.
They've really got kind of a Latin sound to them, though.
You know what's funny, Ann, is when you listen to their album, you can often think any of their albums, they're compilations, because one song will be reggae, one will be loungy jazz, one is kind of Latin. They're all over the place in a wonderful kind of way.
And that is true also of Thievery Corporation.
Totally.
I mean, I remember seeing them a couple years ago, and they... You know, there's a different singer for every song.
For
it's
sure.
And completely different vibe.
I saw him in Red Rocks, and they opened the show with the guy sitting on the rug with the sitar, and you're thinking, really, sitar? I love it. Yeah. Well, let's move on to Thievery then. Eric Hilton has got a brand new release. It's called The Vagabond. No, I'm sorry, Sound Vagabond. And we're going to hear a little bit of a song called Closer. And you're going to see right now how much Eric Hilton's solo work is so much like the Thievery Corporation, his band. Here they are. That is so typically Thievery.
I mean, there is always such rhythm.
And they're so dreamy. They're so, you know, you can float away listening to Thievery Corporation. That's why I've been playing them for 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, they're soothing, but they're so funky. They are,
totally. And very political. I mean, some of their albums are political as the day is long.
Yeah.
And then others. What Eric does is more dreamy and spacey. What his partner Rob does is a little more danceable and a little more political. So I love Eric's because it just takes me to the Thievery every time he releases something. And up next, I love this group. And I guess, have you seen the Local Natives?
Local Natives, yeah.
They're just so good.
Fun.
They've got a brand new single out called April. And
Beautiful harmonies.
Give a listen. Nice summer music.
April, I'm dying to know where. what you're thinking. Somewhere, sometimes, do you feel the same thing? Yeah. Oh, my mind, I can't let go.
Is that summer music or what?
It's totally. I mean, they're Los Angeles based, but they are.
You know more about them than I do. I love it.
They're kind of gotten some comparisons to Fleet Foxes, absolutely. But they're not quite as soupy.
No. And I bought the last one on vinyl, and it was a box set practically. And it was as much, there were like 10 pages of artwork, 12 by 12 with the record. Crazy how much production they put into just their presentation. But this is not here. Let's crank it up one more time. We hear a little more. Yeah, good, we like that.
Good stuff. So that's Saturday night. You've got a great lead-in as well.
Oh, we have such great programs. You got to listen to the Jack's Music Hour with Hurley Winkler. Last week, she went country.
That's
whole hour of country. It was great. I loved it. This week, who knows? And then you got to stick around at 9 for The Neighborhood with Al Pete. The best hip-hop, new R&B, old R&B, and a walk
stuff.
Through the neighborhood.
Yeah,
it's the best.
Great.
And you'll hear Love Culture at Ebonique and all of our favorites on his program. And then, of course, at 10 at the Electro Lounge, we help you forget that everything Ann has told you all week long. We just try and wipe that out of your head.
Just erase it all.
Exactly. So we're excited about having some really strong local programs Saturday nights on the main channel.
Well, we'll take us past Sunday. We've got something new coming.
Oh, we got something really good coming. Sunday at 7, we have a new series called Jazz Beyond Tradition with triple Grammy Award winner Ulysses Owens Jr.
A local.
He sure is, and he lives half the week in New York and teaches at Juilliard. Yeah, he's a real loser. Why don't we get him? And Keanu Faircloth. They will host it. It will be on Sunday nights at 7 on WJCT News 89.9, and The Independent will simulcast it.
Well, David Luckin, so much for being here. We appreciate the preview.
Thank you for inviting me.
And that's our program. If you missed anything, you will be able to listen to the rebroadcast at 8 o'clock tonight. But all of our shows are archived at WJCT.org and on your favorite podcast platform. Don't forget to listen Saturday at 4 when neurologist Dr. Joe Servin talks about the importance of organ donation on What's Health Got to Do with It. Join us again Monday when we discuss the latest in the high-profile criminal case against the couple accused of murdering Microsoft executive Jared Bridegain. I'm Ann Schindler, and you've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.